Let me start off. I'll start off with just how long you've been doing audio stuff, and I'll just kick it off that way, and then we'll talk about just some designs and stuff.
Yeah, well, I started doing electronic stuff or got interested in kindergarten kind of thing. You know, like they say, when you learn a foreign language when you're young, you become very fluent in it. You know, because it's embedded at a deeper level of, you know, your brain structure.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the electronics with me is kind of the same way. It's like a second language to me.
Fascinating.
You know, and I started doing the ham radio thing and all of that kind of stuff, and God, I was 65 or something like that. Parents bought a drum set and went down the slippery road of musicianship, which is probably never a good thing. I think most parents back then, once they realized what it was, they started regretting it. You know, that wasn't a smart thing for us to do. It's not going where we thought it was
going. Clarinet or drums? Yeah, it's like you definitely
rock and roll. Oh, there's drugs. you know. Which, you know,
it seemed like a good idea at the time.
Yeah. You know, fortunately, I avoided most of that, but good upbringing, I guess.
Yeah.
But
well, let me just stop and say, because we sort of just hopped in here. This is Dave Hill of Crane Song, and we're going to be talking today just a little bit about the background of the company and about him and his interests. You know, obviously, he started in kindergarten.
Well, and then at some point, you know, he got drums. Well, we need amplifiers. Well,
oh, of course you have to have amplifiers.
Yeah, so you start, you know, well, I can build an amplifier. you know, and at that point there was magazines with popular electronics and stuff, and
They
actually published real things that you could do, unlike what the magazines have become today, little toy circuits, and, you know, here's a 100-watt amplifier into 4 ohms, you know, so you build one. You know, and then, well, you start building speaker cabinet, and you make mistakes, and things burn up, and you keep at it, and got involved with other bands, and, well, recording, tape recorders, okay, and started playing with tape recorders, and I started doing live sound and working at a music store repairing guitar amps and organs and actually everything that we sold.
I was going to say, anything that walked in the door?
Pretty much, you know, we sold some Moog stuff and, you know, worked on some of that kind of stuff, too, and, you know, after you do it for a while, it, you know, just becomes kind of second nature, and I just kept on doing it, and you know, so I had been building amplifiers, doing sound recording. Some friends started a studio in the basement of a house with a 1-inch MM-1000 8-track reliable machine.
Which breaks down, everything else in the studio.
Yeah, well, most of their breakdowns were due to bad wiring. You cannot have your patch panel be a massive short to the outputs of the channels, you know, without problems.
Yeah.
You know, so that's kind of why I got involved in it, and I kept doing the studio thing, and
were you making all the stuff for your studio at that time?
Well, I was making some stuff. I'd made the monitor board, made some power amps, started dabbling in building some compressor circuits, you know, which actually kind of worked okay. You know, it wasn't the best thing in the world, but it worked. And then at one point, I ended up owning a studio. The other people were out. You know, we were in a building. Okay, I need more than 8 channels. And this is when I, you know, met the Summit people and got connected to that. And then it became if you can design I can sell them. So I did. And hence the TLA 100 and all the Summit stuff through BCL 200.
Okay.
And then when that kind of all went bye-bye, you know, it's like, I got to make a living. At that point, in the meantime, I had taught at the tech school, but because of the Summit thing and bureaucratic differences, I ended up not teaching. Kind of the day after school started, they said, see ya.
Whoops. Good timing.
Yeah. So after the Summit thing was gone, you know, I was okay, well, didn't do anything for a while. I was working on an industrial film, a documentary on a bridge reconstruction. So I did, Nagar Sync sound and played assistant camera, you know, so I was loading, you know, dragging camera and cleaning lenses and loading film magazines and that kind of thing. And
And you thought, you know, designing.
I was enjoying it. The industrial film was $25 an hour. Work as much as you want.
Wow.
So that was a good deal. You work as much and whenever you want. So if you want to spend a day going up there recording sound effects, go for it.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's cool. I love doing something.
Oh, yeah, it was great. Except, you know, you're walking on I-beams 100 to 200 feet in the air following iron workers down. So, you know, it was a little crazy, but so it was great. It was a wonderful time.
So when did you decide to start Crane Song?
In about the time of the summit was gone and doing the industrial film, it became, well, you know, I'm going to build a compressor.
What year would it have been?
Yeah.
Early 90s?
This was, you know, 94-ish or something, 93, 94. You know, I'd have to go look to find out exactly. And it became, everybody was talking about this and that, a compressor, so I put together what everybody wanted. And, of course, they used the word transparent. Well, most people have no idea what transparent means in a compressor.
Right.
But, you know, so I took it literally and made the most transparent thing I could at the time. And also did it so it was going to have great noise floor and low distortion, and, you know, took some unusual approaches in the audio path, plus making it all discrete class A, mm-hmm. and a very, very sophisticated sidechain on it. And hence STC was born, and of course then everybody, you know, had to find somebody to sell it through, and they all said, what, another compressor? But Fletcher and a couple other people listened to it and said, okay, I get it, and, you know, just developed since then. And, you know, the philosophy is to really build the stuff as good as possible, to try and push the envelope to do new things. One of the things I think this is lacking in the whole music industry in general right now is, you know, oh, you're making a clone of a clone of a clone of a clone that doesn't even work anywhere near as good as the original one because you never compared it against that.
Right.
And
the lack of innovation.
Lack of innovation. Lack of creativity. You see it in the music being recorded.
Yeah.
You see it in, well, you know, if you could actually play your instrument, we wouldn't have to edit the solo together note by note.
Yeah.
You know, and I just refuse to do that as a recording engineer. It's like, I'd rather go sleep, you know, than get paid to do that.
It is funny because, you know, we have had this discussion with some designers. It's like, are we left to just nothing but recreating old designs? Is there nothing original left to do?
No, there's original to do. You just got to...
It's just harder.
It's hard work.
Yeah.
Doing head took almost 2 years to develop that, to make it work.
That's a long time. I mean, that's
but you've heard the process, and it's becoming the standard for mastering guys. There's almost...
For good reason.
Yeah, because it makes digital sound better, which is what it was intended to do. And you know, I can't think of many mastering rooms of any significance that doesn't have one.
Yeah.
You know, and it's becoming more and more. It's all trickling down to the mid-level mastering guys. Now, they're all getting into it, and then they're all discovering STC at the same time, and, you know, now, you know, the IBIS equalizer, which was also an unusual filter structure that nobody was doing, and it has a unique sound to it.
Now, is this something you ran across or something you discovered
to start IBIS? It's okay. Well, I can make an inductor-based thing. Everybody else is doing that, and I didn't want to deal with the magnetic field problems.
Mm-hmm.
For once, I wanted to avoid that. Okay, figuring it was going to be easier. Well, it wasn't easier. You know, because things never quite go the way you think it's going to go.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, again, I went to push the envelope as to the knowledge to make it do some new things, make it so it can be transparent, make it so it can be colored, and come up with a filter structure that's short path length.
Mm-hmm.
As you all know, in doing any kind of recording, the more stuff you put in the audio path, the junkier it sounds. So, okay, how can I minimize the signal path? How can I minimize the path through the filter network and still make it tunable so it can be a wide bandwidth or a narrow bandwidth?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and a musician friend suggested, well, instead of putting just frequencies on there, put note names on there too, because we were having a discussion about frequencies and what do people do when if they build an equalizer that's switched. Oh, you can do arbitrary numbers like API did, 100, 50, 200, 300, 400 hertz. Mm-hmm. You can copy Neve frequencies like
resistor code.
One third of the world does, and the other third of the world copies Pultec frequencies. And then, you know, there's a smattering of, you know, like this straight number thing. I said, well, you know, we're supposed to be making music. Why not center the things on note frequencies?
Yeah.
And the friend at the time said, well, if you do that, you can also put note names on it.
Mm-hmm.
So we did kind of a combination of both. You know, some people have a hard time figuring it out.
I was going to say, that's been a love-hate thing. I know.
Yeah. But the ones who have a hard time with it, the example somebody gave me was, well, you know, this guy can't deal with the note names. Well, there are frequencies there, too. This guy can't. Well, there are frequencies there, too. The third engineer, oh, I just turn it up and turn the dial. Okay, it's the right frequency.
Yeah.
He uses his ears.
Not a bad idea.
Yeah, you know, it's like, where have this business and industry become where we rely upon indicators, not using our ears, to see what things really sound like? It seems like not only music-wise, but gear-wise, we want to copy things as opposed to create something new. Innovation is hard work, and when you do it, you present something and people go, I don't understand this, because it's not like the last one.
It doesn't conform. Yeah.
It doesn't conform.
That's why there's so many people that are making microphones that have the names of older microphones, because as soon as you show them this new microphone and it doesn't look like anything that they've ever seen before, they go, well, what does it sound like?
Yeah.
It's like, give me the name of another microphone that I may have heard that it's going to sound like.
Yeah, you know, and I get that question all the time. Okay, the equalizer's up. First question, what equalizers did you A-B it against, and what did you pattern it after? Zero. Same thing with the compressors. Yeah, I'm done. No, it's not patterned after anything. It was made to be its own thing, like the tracker compressor. Yes, you can make it sound like an LA-2A, and you can set it up, switch them in and out, and you can get it so it's very, very hard to tell one from the other.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not primarily what it does. Primarily, it gives you 16 kind of choices in what it can do, and it's also probably the fastest operating compressor that was ever built.
Yeah.
The gain control can go from zero to full gain reduction in something like a half a microsecond.
Wow.
And you know, the side chain slows it down a little bit, and there's reasons where you have to control it some, but it's fast enough that if you don't use your ears, it's gonna be ugly. You gotta use your ears. It's not something that's, you know, foolproof that anybody, that you can just, well, yeah, gee, I think I just set the compressor to, oh, I want a 1 millisecond this and this ratio, and first of all, the stuff we build doesn't work that way because they all interreact.
Mm-hmm.
But music isn't numbers. It isn't about a 5 millisecond attack. It's nice to know maybe the range of what it can do, to know that it can go as long as you need to, but if when you decide that you're going to compress a vocal and all you're concerned about is I want this number on the attack and this number on the release and this ratio, does it say that you're listening?
Right.
Probably not.
It's what I call the red dot syndrome. I used to do work with some churches, and they were just like, well, just come in and set all the knobs where they're supposed to be.
Yeah.
And then they'd follow behind me, and they literally had one of those rolls of little red dots, the little punch-out dots, and then they would go through and stick little dots so that if anybody ever came in and turned the knobs and messed it up, then all they had to do was follow back behind them and match all the pointers to the dots, and then everything was good.
Yeah, in some cases, that might be the only thing that's possible.
Yeah.
In other cases, it's, you know, you got to use your ears, guys. When I was working at the music store, and you know, we were kind of innovative in the area. Sound Craftsman had just came into existence with their graphic equalizers. So we brought those things in for, you know, because, you know, bands, cool, equalizers. And then you'd sell one, and they'd say, well, will you set this for me so it sounds best? Yeah, well, you know,
where?
complete lack of understanding, right. But you know, people got to learn to use their ears. They got to become creative. They got to push the envelope to create new sounds and new songs and new gear. And yeah. If they don't, it stagnates, and everybody loses.
Yeah. But it's hard work.
Well, yeah, doing anything worthwhile is not easy. You know, even copying somebody's old box is hard work, or it can be.
Yeah.
But creating something new is a lot more difficult.
Yeah. Well, now, so this is related to something we talked about probably a year ago, because I know there are a lot of people that think that a box is just translating a schematic off a page onto a PC board or a breadboard, and that if I make sure that this end of that resistor touches this end of that capacitor and this is wired to there, you know, there are some designers that don't have any problem sharing their schematics and just saying, hey, here's my work, it's published, it's a PDF, just download it, knock yourself out. What do you think about that? I mean, do you don't publish your designs. I mean,
somebody who has legitimate needs for drawings will give them to them. I've had people at this K-pop thing even, well, can I have a schematic for an STC-8 so I can build one? Well, there's about 900 parts in it. It has something like almost 2 years of work to develop that thing, and the mechanical on it is as critical, if not more critical, than the electrical to get it to work.
Interesting.
So they're not going to be able to make it work anyway, chances are.
So if they put all the pieces in the right place, is it going to sound like an SCCM?
Probably not. They're not going to. It's there is a little, there's some art to it. When you push the envelope, you have, yeah, you can say standard engineering, scientific, whatever, but I don't start with numbers. I start with ideas and a concept of what I'm trying to do. I build some circuits, do some measurements to know that, okay, it works. I listen to it. I don't measure the distortion that the box has in the audio path until basically it's done. I don't actually measure the distortion to see what it is.
Okay.
I don't make decisions based upon that. I make decisions based upon my ears. And if I know that it passes a square wave cleanly and a triangle wave and a sine wave, you know, without actually doing distortion measurements, and I know it does it at large signal and small signal, and knows that I've been using it for a while in the studio, you know, I still do sessions 2-3 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
You know, plus all like ancillary editing and setup for duplication and CD mastering and all that kind of stuff. The ears tell you more than the numbers. So that's why I always say, I know that it's in the ballpark of the design criteria. When the thing's done, we'll actually measure what it does. Which is part of the reason I don't publish specs, because they don't really tell you useful stuff. And the way, you know, it's great, you look at somebody's specs in their mic pre-ad and go, well, in order to get that noise floor, you know, in the real world, with a 150-ohm microphone, mm-hmm. Let's see, the microphone and the preamp's going to need some cryogenic cooling to come up with the numbers they come, you know, and, you know, cause they're doing it with a shorted input or something.
Right,
it's not real.
Right.
And you know, people look at that and, well, first of all, the numbers don't tell you anything about what it sounds like.
Right.
And the way the numbers are being generated isn't valid anyways to make comparisons from one to the other.
Right. It's like comparing converters. I mean, you can look at two units that have almost identical specs. And, you know, the frequency response is ruler flat and the noise is, you know, virtually the same. And then you listen to through two of them. One sounds huge and warm, and the other sounds like a transistor radio.
Yeah.
And you go, how is that possible?
Yeah. Well, yeah. The specs do not tell everything. We do not know how to measure everything that the ear can hear.
Yeah.
Actually, we don't even know everything that the ear can hear at this point, which is even beyond knowing how to measure it. We don't even know what we're supposed to be measuring.
Exactly. We don't even have the criteria for this. So if there was a common thread to all the different types of gear that you design, what is the lowest common denominator? What is the common thread?
Trying to make it as flexible as possible, in this day and age, when you're looking for creating different sounds, you have to be able to have go from one kind of thing to another in a hurry. It needs to be in when doing a session, you know, and the common deal is you got a new client, you got them up half and working, they're all complaining about this and that, and the headphones, and the drums don't sound good, and the guitar is weird, and all this stuff. You know, when the pressure's really on. When you're, mm-hmm. And if you can reach to that box behind you, turn the knob quickly, and solve a problem, you know you're in the ballpark.
That's great.
If you got to sit there and fiddle with it for 5 minutes while people are playing to get that particular item going through that box to sound good, you got something wrong there.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't work. So it has to work in the real situation, which is, you know, part of the thing with my studio. Everything's pretty much run for 9 months plus in a real studio before I even release it to what I would call beta to anybody. And generally at that point, you know, there are a few suggestions that people come up with and we incorporate it when we can. But so it's got to work under pressure. It's got to be flexible. We're trying to maintain very respectable specs on it. You know, the noise floor like an STC8 at Unity gains like minus 89, minus 90 dBm.
Wow.
And clippings plus 25.
Wow.
You know, so it's actually arguably one of the more quiet compressors on the market. But, you know, the spec doesn't... It sounds good. That's more important.
Yeah. And it sounds good. It sounds good to you. I mean, the thing that... One of the things that all the gear that you have, even with the variety of pieces, is that you have tuned them not necessarily to the audience at large. I mean, basically, you've made them to sound good to you, right?
Yes, I made them to sound good to me.
Okay.
And so they have all that flexibility, and you know, to be able to create different sounds. You know, tracker or head are good examples where you got knobs where you can drastically change what things sound like. And we build the stuff as best as we can. You know, and at this point we've got a very, very low failure rate, and yeah, you always run into problems, and they're the strangest problems in the world. Sometimes you just, how can that be? And you can take that box and you bring it in to the shop, and you can never reproduce the problem.
Because you're taking it out of that the environment that where it was that was
and
causing.
And the weirdest thing is you can give the guy another box, a different one, and he will never be able to recreate that problem. And the one that had that problem, you can take that to half a dozen different studios, and you can never recreate the problem. You know,
it's got to be hard designing PC because you never know where they're going to end up and how they're going to be connected.
Yeah, well, you have to assume it's not going to be used in any manner that you intended. Okay, you have to make that assumption.
And
you also have to assume a large portion of people have questionable wiring and power and all of those things that are going to make issues that are very strange also.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and at this point, we're basically running an unlimited warranty on the stuff.
Wow.
You know, lifetime warranty on it. And
that's
we don't see that many pieces. It's weird stuff. Oh, if somebody smashes one, we had a compressor that was on the road with Neil Young, and the rack in the truck did this.
Did a nosedive?
Yeah. Did a nosedive. Ripped the steel chassis. Most of the way through, actually ripped the steel. Well, yeah, you know, and the front of house guy when he sent it in, here's Neil's credit card number, just fix it.
Thank you. Well, Dave, thank you very much.
Well, thank
it's
you.
It's always a pleasure talking to you. It's I think you're one of the geniuses in this industry, and it's always, I always learn something every time I talk to you.
Well, I have a great time talking to, like, with you and George and Hutch and everybody, because the interchange of ideas is one of the things that helps fuel the innovation to go forward.
Yeah.
And I think more of that kind of thing needs to happen.
I agree. I don't want this industry, especially the equipment manufacturing side of this industry, to become stagnated. I don't want us to be just making clones of clones of clones.
Yeah, or it becomes Yamaha. You know, and it's like so much for creativity and trying to make things as good as you possibly can.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.